Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Yud-Chet Amud Aleph. The Gemara here is continuing the discussion of Rabbi Yehoshua's position in the Mishnah. We left off yesterday with the discussion, why is it that the case in which Modeh Rabbi Yehoshua in our Mishnah is a case where we deal with an individual speaking about the field of this individual's father, and he says that this was your father's field, and I purchased it from him. And in that case, he is Neman, because of Pesha Asur, Pesha Hitir. And the Gemara wanted to know, why can't we have that case be about the party himself and not about his father? So the Gemara discussed that yesterday and answered that question. The Gemara is now going to continue to propose other alternatives to what the case could have been in the Mishnah that Rabbi Yehoshua would have agreed that the individual is believed. The litnei, Modeh Rabbi Yehoshua, Beomer Lechaveiro, why don't we say that Rabbi Yehoshua would agree that the individual is believed in an instance where he says to his friend, Mane Leviti Mimcha, I borrowed 100 zuz from you, that I paid them back, Shuneman, that he's believed over there. Again, it's a case of Pesha Asuhua Pesha Hitir, number one. According to Rashi, it's a case of Ein Shor Shachut Lefanecha, because here there was no Toveya. An individual didn't make any claim against him. He's volunteering the information. Of course, Tosafot Lishitato would say that this is even in the face of a Toveya. And in this case, he's believed because he's admitting to the loan, but he also is saying that I paid back the loan. Right? Says Mishum de Gabay Lemitne Seifa, because of the latter half of the Mishnah would not fit in this case. Im Yesh Edim Shuhulava Mimenu, if there are actually witnesses to the fact that he borrowed the money, Vilomer Perativ Eno Me'aman, and if he says that I paid them back, in that case, he's not believed. Is that really true? I mean, the way that our Mishnah is structured is, in the first part, Rabbi Yehoshua says, the individual is believed because of a Pesha Asur or Pesha Hitir. And the second half, the Edim take away that aspect of a Pesha Asur or Pesha Hitir. So in the case that we're proposing over here, where the person admits to borrowing the money and says, I repaid it, is that true as well? When Edim show up, does that mean if we have Edim to the loan, that means that if he says, I paid it back, he's not believed? V'hakayim alon, don't we have a principle? Hamalved chavero be'edim. Someone who lends an individual money in front of Edim, there is no demand on the loveh, on the borrower, the debtor, to pay back in front of Edim, unless that's specifically stipulated in the contract or in the agreement that he pays back in front of Edim. The loveh is not under an obligation to repay in front of Edim. So if that is the case, then in this instance as well, even if we have Edim to the fact that the loan was actually granted and this debtor borrowed the money, he could still make the claim, Pirativ, I paid it back, because he's under no obligation to pay back in front of Edim. And if he says Pirativ, he says I paid it all back, he's a kofer bekol, and we would believe him in that case. So therefore, that cannot be the structure of the case in the Mishnah, because when there are Edim there, the person is also Ne'eman, and wouldn't fit into the structure that we're looking for, where in the first instance, he would be believed, and in the second instance where there are Edim, he would not be believed. So Gemara now proposes another alternative. Vilitnei Modeh Rabbi Yehoshua beomer lechaveiro mane lavicha biyadi vechaltiv pras. Why don't we say the case in the Mishnah is an instance where a person comes and volunteers the information that I owe 100 zuz to your father and I gave back half of it. I repaid half of it, shu neman. In that case, he is believed. So instead of having the case be a case of sadeh or a field that he speaks about, let us be a case about a monetary transaction, metaltaline, a loan, where he says that your father lent me money or granted me this, and I gave him back half of it. So Aliba Daman, the Gemara says, according to whom is this? E Aliba de Rabbonon, if this is according to the Rabbonon, Hamre Mishiva Veda Havi, that this person who's giving back the money is the equivalent of giving back an Aveda. He's not under any obligation, and therefore, when he volunteers this information, it's like he's being a good guy and granting the money back. E Aliba de Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, Ha'amar Shvua Boy. As according to Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, he would require a Shvua over here because he is a Modeh b'miktzat. And we have a principle in the Torah, a person who has a claim made against them, if they agree that the claim is there, but they say I paid back a portion of it, or only a portion of the claim is right, they are Modeh b'miktzat, they agree to a portion of the claim being made against them, they are under an obligation to take a Shvua. So according to Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, this is an instance of Modeh b'miktzat, and therefore the individual will be a chayav to take a shvua. So that's certainly not the case of the Mishnah. According to the Rabbanan, there's no question that this individual is believed over here, because he's kamei shiva veda. It's as if he's giving back the money to this individual, and he was under no obligation. So of course he's believed over here. Now, according to Rashi, the Chiddush in the Rabbanon is that even if the other individual made a claim against him, even if he was Toveya, the individual, and he said, yes, I did have this money from your father, and I gave back half of it, then he still believed in its Gemeshi Baveda. Now, according to Rashi, that means that's not the case of our Mishnah, because the case of our Mishnah is Ein Shor Shachut Lefanecha, that the Shor Shachut is not present there, which means, according to Rashi, there was no Toveya, there was no claimant over here. So Rashi says, in that case, the Rabbanim would say, even if there was a claimant, even if the son came and made the claim, the individual, according to the Rabbanim, would still be believed. So for Rashi, that's not the case of the Mishnah. And that's what the Gemara is saying over here, Mimonav Shach, this isn't the case of the Mishnah. For the Rabbanim, even if there was a Toveya, they would say he doesn't have to do anything, he's believed. And according to Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, you have to take a Shavua, neither of which fit into the Mishnah, which is a case where we believe him, as long as there's no claimant. That is at least according to Rashi's approach. On the other hand, according to Tosafot, who says even when there's a Toveya, even when there's a claimant, we still say that he is Neman in our Mishnah, then the Chiddush here, according to the Rabbanon, is what Tosafot says, Vim gein lo matzi lemitne, vim yesh edim, enu Neman. Then he can't write the latter half of the Mishnah, which says that if there are edim there, he's not believed. Tololam Neman b'migo. Then he is believed in amigo. Di bayam arperati hakol. That he could say that I paid it all back. The fact now that he agrees that he paid half of it back and is willing to pay the other half is Gemeshi Vaveda. And therefore, even the face of Edim, this individual is believed. So according to Tosafot, the reason it doesn't fit in here into our Mishnah is because according to the Chachamim, even if there are Edim there, this individual will be believed. On the other hand, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov requires a Shvua, neither of which are true in our Mishnah. Detanya, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov Omer, Pe'amim Sha'adam Nishba Al Tanat Atzmo. There are times when a person takes a shvua on his own claim. Ketzad, what is an instant like that? Maneh l'avicha biyadi, I have 100 zuz that your father lent me, v'chaltiv pras, and I repaid half of them. Hari zeh nishba, he takes a shvua. So even though all of the information that we have here is being generated by the person volunteering the information, nevertheless, we classify him as a modem miksat, and Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says he takes a shvua. So here is someone, al tanat atzmo, because of his own claim, because of his own statement, he ends up having to take a shvua. V'achamim omim, enu elo gemeshiva veda upatur. This individual is not obligated to take a shvua over here. He's the one volunteering the information. It's as if he's giving back an aveda, and he should be patur. Now, in terms of meshiva veda, we're going to see in a second what the source for this is, but the idea being that if a person volunteers or gives back an aveda, we're not going to then obligate them to take a shvua, because if we obligate them to take a shvua, then they're not going to be meshiv the aveda. It's not worth their time, or they're not going to engage in the aveda to return it, if they're then going to be held accountable to take a shvua for it. So over here, the Chachamim say that this individual volunteered the information, he's like a meshiv aveda, and therefore he's patur from shvua. The Gemara says, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, late meshiv aveda patur? How is it possible that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov doesn't subscribe to this position? According to Rashi, this is the Mishnah in Gittin, which says that there's a takanat derabanan, then a person, a motze mitziah, lo yishba, person who finds a mitziah does not have to take a shvua, mipnei tikkun olam. Because of tikkun olam, basically what I just explained here, that if we force people to take a shvua when they find an aveda and they want to return an aveda, they will not get engaged with avedot. They will not return items because of the burden of the shvua that is associated with it. So mipnei tikkun olam, we allow these people to return the items without a shvua. On the other hand, Tosafot says that's not the question of the Gemara. The question of the Gemara is not from the Mishnah in Gittin, but the Gemara's question is, midoraita. Here in Minah Torah, you have a migo. The person here has a migo that he should be believed because he could just withhold the Aveda and keep it for himself. The fact that he's coming here and telling us that he has the Aveda or he has something that he's volunteering, that's already a migo he should be believed because he had a better taina. The better taina was that he could have just kept it, or he could have kept silent over here. And therefore, the Gemara asks, doesn't Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov recognize that there's a migo over here? And if he recognizes there's a migo, then certainly the individual should be patur min ha-shvua. And the same in our case. In the instance here where he's volunteering this information to the party, saying that your father lent me the money and I paid half of it back, it's the same thing. He has amigo. He could have just remained silent and said nothing. So he should have a nemanut here. How come Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov doesn't subscribe to that core position? Amarav, the answer is, b'toano katan. It's a case where there is a claimant on the other side, but the claimant happens to be a katan, a minor. Vaha Marmar. Don't we have a Mishnah that says, Ein Nishba'im Altanat Cheresh Shotevi Katan, that one does not take a Shvua on the claim of a Cheresh Shotevi Katan. They're not considered to be Ish. They're not considered to be men who can generate a necessity for a Shvua. And therefore, how could it be here that the Tana, the claim of the Katan, does anything to change the dynamic of the situation? Whether it's because of his own volunteering of the information, or whether it's because we have a claimant that's a Katan on the other side, that shouldn't make any difference to the situation. My answer is, my Katan. What is meant by Katan over here? Gadol. It really means that he is a person of age. So he does have the ability to generate a claim against the other party. But my Harile Katan. So then why does Rav call him a Katan over here? Delegabe Mile Daviv Katanu. Because in relationship to his father's business dealings, he is a Katan. Because he is not making a claim on behalf of himself. He's making a claim based on his father's dealings. If that's the case now, where we have someone of age making a claim over here, and he is admitting to a portion of it, then why is that called Tanat Atzmo? That's what Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov described before. And there's sometimes where a person takes a shvua on his own claim. Tanat Atzmo. So then Gemara says, Ihochi Tanat Atzmo, Tanat Acherimi. It's not his own claim. It's the claim of this son who is of age, who's coming to make a claim and asking him for the money that is owed to his father. Tanat Acherim, Vodat Atzmo. Gemara says, no, it's a claim from a third party, you're right, from the son on behalf of the father. But Vodat Atzmo, but he's admitting portion, and that's what's driving the shvua over here. He's a modu mikzat. Gemara says, Kolo Tanata, any claim, anything that's modu mikzat in the Torah, is Tanata Acherim, Vodat Atzmo Ninu. It's a claim by another party, and then the individual admits to a portion of it, and that's what generates the shvua. Now, the Gemara here has a girsa. This is the girsa according to Rashi, which is Ella. Ella is a code word in the Gemara, which means that we reject the previous assumption, and now we're moving on to something else. According to Rashi, it means Ela, that the Olam Bitano Katan. The case is here that the Katan, a minor, made the claim over here. Behocha b'drabo b'kamiflege. And they're arguing within Rabo. So we'll explain that in a second. But according to Rashi, we're talking about a case where the Gemara rejected the answer that it gave before. Now it's going back to explain Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov's position, where there's a certain case, Al Tanat Atzmo, where he can be Nishba. That is a case where the Katan, a real minor, makes a claim against him. Now we'll explain why that is, or what the nuance of that is. According to Tosafot, the Gemara does not reject the previous answer, but continues along with this, V'nired achi perusho l'olam b'gadol mairi. That we continue to say that we're talking about a gadol over here in the claimant. Right now we'll explain the Gemara, we'll come back and show why this makes a difference. This is a fundamental Gemara in Shvua. It is a large Gemara in Baba Kama and Baba Metzia as well, where Rashi and Tosafot argue about the details of everything that's being said here, and we'll go through it piece by piece. We'll read the whole thing and then come back and go piece by piece and explain the differences and the nuances in their opinion. Now, Dama Rabba. Rabba says, Mipnei ma amra Torah, mode b'mitzata ta'ana yishava. Why does the Torah say that someone who admits to a portion of a claim against him must take a shvua? Chazaka, en adam me'iz panav mipnei bal chovo. We have a chazaka that a person will not be so brazen as to deny a loan from his creditor. V'hai b'kula b'ayi l'kafre. And he should have, in essence, denied the entire thing. V'hai d'lo kafarle. Why isn't he denying the whole claim over here? Mishum dein adam is panav. Who? Because a person will not be so brazen as to deny the loan. He knows that he owes the money. He knows that there's a loan outstanding. But he doesn't have the gumption to go ahead and deny the fact that there is a loan. So what does he do? He creates in his mind, he justifies doing something along these lines, which is, Rabakula by a low delay. He should have admitted to the entire obligation over here. By the low delay. So then why didn't he admit to it? He needs to buy more time in order to repay the loan. Visavar, adavale zuze. When I have enough time, uparanale, and I'll pay back the remainder. So basically what he does is he wants to buy himself time. So he's motive and mikzat because that's the money that he has on hand and he's going to pay him. He can't deny the whole thing because he has his bal chov looking at him and he can't do that. So therefore he goes, you know what, I'll admit to half of it and that'll buy me time to pay off the remaining half. Rachman Amar in the Torah says, Rami shvuale, put a shvu on him, ki echid lo delei bigule, in order that he will admit to the entire amount. All right, we're going to come back and discuss Rava's position in a second, but just here to explain the machlok between Rav Elazar ben Yaakov and the Chachamim. Rav Elazar ben Yaakov savar lo shna bo v'lo shna bebeno einu meis. Doesn't matter whether it's the father or whether it's the son. The individual, the debtor over here, will not be so brazen as to deny the claim. And therefore, hilgach lo meshiv avedo yuhavi. He's not a meshiv aveda because he has a certain amount of guilt or obligation that he feels towards the father, and he feels that same way towards the son. So when he says whatever he's saying over here, it's because he has something compelling him to do that. And because of that, we don't believe him, and we force him to take a shvua. Rabbanan savrei, Rabbanan believe, bohu deinu meiz. When it comes to the creditor himself, there he is not willing or brazen enough to deny the claim. Aval bibno meiz. But when it comes to the child, who wasn't the direct party to the loan, over there he would be brazen enough to deny the whole thing. Umdelo heiz, and since he didn't do that, meshiv aveda habi. He's the equivalent of a meshiv aveda. Alright, we're going to explain all of these details now, but that is the basic machloka, but the Gemara is suggesting over here. According to Rashi, again, we're starting with a katan, starting with a minor who comes and makes a claim here on behalf of the father's estate. And the individual goes back and says, you're right, Enoch Hanami, your father did lend me that money, but I paid back half of it. In that case, the Chachamim say he's Kameshiva Veda. Since he has no relationship with this son, then he could be willing to deny the entire claim. Since he's willing to deny the entire claim and he goes ahead and admits to half of it, he has a Migo to be believed. The same Migo he has by Meshiva Veda, as Tosafot said before, which is that he could have just held on to the Veda, he could have hidden it. The fact that he admits he has it, or he's telling you he has a portion of something, that should not obligate him in a Shavua, because he has a Migo, he could have just denied the whole thing. Similarly over here, to this son, he had a better claim. If he didn't want to pay, he could have just said, Lo ayu dvarim me'olam, it never happened. Since he admitted to half of it, that's a Kameshiva Veda, it's a Migo that he's being generous and giving it back, and he is believed, therefore he's ne'eman without a shvua about that portion, because he could have denied the whole thing without any problem. On the other hand, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says that this individual feels the same way towards the son as he would have felt towards the creditor. And just like by the creditor, it was not an option for him to deny the entire claim, because ein adam meiz panav bifnei bal chovo. An individual will not deny the entirety of a claim against him in front of his creditor. And so too, the same is true by the son as well. Just like the father, he would not have the gumption to do it. He would not do it in front of the son. That means that we've denied him, or we don't expect him to make that claim. That claim is not an option for him. The claim which he says that I owe nothing is not open to him. So therefore, when he comes and makes a claim that I owe half, that's not Kameshiva Veda, because he didn't have a better claim. That is the best claim. Since that is the best claim, he's not a meshiv aveda, but rather modem mixat, and he has to take a shvua, whether it's a case where the son is making the claim, or in a case where it's the father making the claim, he'll have to take a shvua. Again, according to Rashi, it's a katan, a minor here, who is making the claim against him. Now we're going to continue to explain, piece by piece, the Gemara according to Rashi. Rashi over here says, what is the reason that ein adam me'iz panav bifnei ba'al chovo? What is the reason that a person is not willing to be brazen and deny a loan from a creditor, is because, as Rashi says, shasalo tova, that he did something nice for him. This person was generous enough to lend him the money. The fact that he lent him the money makes him indebted, not just for the money, but also for the tzad that he was willing to lend the money. And that makes him feel uneasy to take away or deny that chesed that this individual did by lending him the money. So when he goes back, ein adam me'iz panav bibel chol chovo means that he has a certain gratitude towards this individual. Now the question between Rabbi Elazar and Yaakov and the Chachamim is, does that gratitude extend to the son as well? According to Rashi, for sure, to the creditor, he has that gratitude. The question, or the machlok between Rabbi Elazar and Yaakov and the Chachamim is, does that gratitude extend to the son? And if it does extend to the son, then he would not be willing to deny the entire loan to the son. Whereas, if it doesn't extend to the son, he would have no problems denying it completely to the son. Now, as many of the Rishonim point out, not here, but in other places, that the problem with Rashi's Shita is that that means that it's only true by Halva'a. That the din of Modem Miksat, according to Rashi, is only true when you're dealing with loans. But if you're dealing with a Pikadon, when you're dealing with Shomrim, where you hand over something to be watched by the other individual, where there is no Tova, there's no Chesed being done by the party that gives over the Pikadon, it might even actually be the reverse. The Shomer, who's watching it might be the one who's doing the chesed over here. Even if he's getting paid, it still might be nice that he's willing to take the item. And therefore, according to Rashi, there should be no din of rabba when it comes to modav mixad by shomrim, by pikadon, by other matters that do not involve a halva'a. And that's where the Rishonim Tosafot takes issue with Rashi and says that we do find other places in Shas where modav mixad applies even outside the context of halva'a of loans. Therefore, Tosafot gives two other alternatives as to what it means ein adam me'iz panav yimnei ba'al chuvo. Number one is the Rabbeinu Tam, who says that chazakah, that an individual will not be meiz panav the kforet hakol. It's just a psychological part of a person that if they did borrow money, they can't bring themselves psychologically to deny the entire thing. A person does not want to tell a total lie. People, when they lie, try to mix in the truth a little bit with the lie. So they won't lie completely. They'll tell a half-truth. And that's what it means, in adam meiz panav bifnei ba'al chovo, which is that a person doesn't have the psychological wherewithal in order to lie completely and deny something that really happened. And so therefore, in order to make the lie palatable, they're willing to mix it up with the truth, partial truth and partial lie. And that's what brings an individual not to deny the entirety of the loan or the entirety of whatever circumstance it is, and to admit to a portion of it because they're willing to lie a little, but not to lie completely. That's what the Rabbeinu Tam says in psychology. The Riva brings an additional view here, which is that ein adam meiz panav, when someone else knows they're lying. When you're facing the other individual and they know for sure you're lying, a person can't lie to the face of another individual when he knows they know they're lying. So all of this is, again, it's a very, very big issue in terms of psychology. And the psychology, according to Rashi, is the gratitude that the debtor has to the creditor, and that prevents him from denying the entire loan. According to Rabbeinu Tam, it's the fact that a person can't psychologically bring themselves to lie and deny something completely. They have to mix it. They need to tell a half-truth in order to make it palatable to themselves. Or the Riva, who says when somebody is standing opposite you who knows the truth, the person can't lie straight to their face. So that's the psychology here of modav b'miksat, which basically takes away the option that this person has to deny the entire thing. Since it takes away the option to deny the entire thing, then he no longer has a migo to be naman. When he admits to half of it, it's not because he has another option to deny the whole thing. And here, when he admits to half of it, wow, we should just be happy and we should believe him because he could have denied the whole thing. What it's saying is that avenue of denying the whole amount is not open to him. Since that's not open to him, when he comes here and admits to half of it, that is his best claim, and therefore he no longer has a migo by which to be believed. And then Rabbo explains to us the logic behind that. The logic as to why a person, first of all, will act in this way. And number two is to why the Torah obligated this individual to take a shvuah over here. And that comes back to what we said before, where Rashi says that the case here, or the continuation of the Gemara, is talking about a katan that makes the ta'ana. And according to Rashi, seemingly what the Gemara is explaining over here in Rabba's position is, why is it that the Torah says you take a shvuah by modav b'miksat? And why is it that you don't take a shvuah by kofar b'kol? So what Rabba has explained to us, the first explanation is he takes a shvuah by modav b'miksat, not only because the migo is denied, but because this person really is trying to slip out of things, and that's why we are telling him to make a shvuah. On the other hand, why by kofar akol does he not have to take a shvuah, according to Rashi? And that is the next line in the Gemara. Ubekula bayilodi. And he should have been kofar bakol. But he isn't, because chazaka in adam is panah bifnei bal chovo. And that explains us the other half of the puzzle, is why doesn't he have to take a shvuah when he's kofar bakol? Since there is a chazaka that a person would not deny the entire event, if he goes ahead and denies the entire event, then we believe him, because he shouldn't be doing that, or psychologically, he shouldn't be able to get to that point. And since he can't get to that point, he is then believed as a kofar bakol. So according to Rashi, the two points here in Rabba are, number one, why do you take a shvuah by modav miksat? And why don't you have to take a shvuah by kofar akol? And that's what's being explained by Rabba. And according to Rashi, that is, the case here is talking about a katan that makes the claim. Whereas according to Tosafot, the Gemara here continues along the path that this katan is not really a katan, but he is a gadol. He really is someone of age. Because he says, if the Gemara switched gears here and went back to katan, ikar chasar min ha-sefer, the majority or the main answer is missing. We never see the Gemara say that again, and it's missing from the Gemara. So therefore, we must be talking about a gadol. Now, if we're talking about a gadol, obviously the biggest problem, why Rashi says it this way, is because it says, Shein Adam Nishbal Tanat Atzmo. How is it called Tanat Atzmo? According to Rashi, it's very simple to understand now. It's called Tanat Atzmo because there's a Katan making a claim, and that Katan carries no weight, and therefore it triggers him to say something, but it's Tanat Atzmo. In the end, it's his speaking that generates everything that happens over here. On the other hand, Tosafot says that we have to be talking about a Gadol, because the Gemara never showed that switch in gears, and therefore he has to explain why is it called Tanat Atzmo if he's really a Gadol. If he's a Gadol, he has the power to make a claim on his own. So Tosafot says, V'hochi kama Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, Pamim shadam nishba al ma shatem machshivim Tanat Atzmo. Sometimes a person takes a shvua on something that looks like it's his own Tana, according to you, Chachamim. Aval didi eno meiz Tanat Achirimi. But according to me, where a person is not meiz bifnei bino, then it's Tanat Achirim. So what Tosafot says is that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is saying this in the position of the Chachamim. He says, what you call Tanat Atzmo, because you say that a person will be meiz pana before the son of the creditor, and therefore he's kemeshiva veda, he's volunteering the information, and he would be kofar bakol, the fact that he is modir miksat should give him amigo to be believed over here. I say that that's not called Tanat Atzmo, that's called Tanat Achirim, because I think that a person is not meiz panav in front of the son of the creditor, and because of that, he is therefore obligated to take a shua modeh mimiksat. For Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov en Ochanami, it is Tanat Achirim, but he is saying this, in your position, what you call Tanat Atzmo Chachamim, I don't think it's called Tanat Atzmo, it's really called Tanat Achirim, because we argue about the relationship between the debtor and the son of the creditor. Then Tosafot goes on to explain that over here, Rabbu is not explaining why the individual takes a shvua b'modim miksat. Because Tosafot says that just like a person wants to slip out of having to pay, he would say modim miksat, he would only admit to a portion of it. So too, he might be kofar bakol. So too, he might deny the entire amount. Also, we find places in the Gemara that a person is trying to slip out of having to pay, that he will be kofar bakol. But what Tosafot says, Rabbu comes to explain to us is that why is he then not believed? If a person's willing to deny the whole loan, and he's willing to deny half of the loan, then he has amigo and he should be believed. What Rabbah comes to explain to us is why that's not amigo. And the answer is because he has much easier time being modem miksat than kofar bakol. Kofar bakol is a very difficult thing for him to do. He might do it, but it's very difficult for him to do it. Therefore, if he comes as modem miksat, it's not automatic that we say, oh, he should be believed because he had a better claim to deny the whole thing. Because denying the whole thing may not really be in his toolbox. It may not be something that he can do because of what Rabbah explains, that ein adam me'iz panav yifnei bal chovo. So what Rabbah is coming to explain is why there is no migo over here. It's not coming to explain why there's a shvua by modem miksat. He's explaining why there's no migo over here, why he's not automatically believed. A derivative of that is the fact that he has to take a shvua. But Rabbah is not coming to explain here why yes by modem miksat and not by kofar bakol. And actually you would come to the opposite conclusion then, by kofar bakol. That the reason that we say the person has to take a shvua by modem miksat is ein adam me'iz panav, that means in a place where we fear he would be me'iz panav, then not there would be amigo, but you'd have to take a shvua there, because then we'd be afraid that he's going to lie through and through, and he should make him take a shvua in any of those instances. And we know that's not true. We know that a kofar bakol is patur and not chayav. Tosafot then says, how do you know that a kofar bakol is patur, and modem miksat is chayav b'shvua? He says, first of all, gzeirat ha-katuv, possibly, which is ki hu zeh, which is the lashon of the Torah. Or he says the possibility is that modem miksat generates what's called a gilgul shvua. Since we're already going to engage him on the portion that he's going to pay and take a shvua there, then we force him to take a shvua on the other half that he denies. And then by kofar bakol, he's pulling himself out of the case entirely, and then we have no way to engage him with a shvua. So that's what Tosafot says, either as a gzeirat ha-katuv, or the logic behind why by modem miksat you take a shvua, and by kofar bakol, you do not take a shvua. Whereas Rashi believes that Rabbah is explaining why by modem miksat you do take a shvua, and by kofar bakol you do not take a shvua. Tosafot says he's only explaining why there's no migo by modem miksat, and why he's not automatically believed. The reason that there's a difference between modem miksat and kofar bakol, he gave as a different explanation, nothing to do with Rabbah. Now, the Gemara continued here on the top of Yudchet Amud Bet and said, "Bukula b'ayle d'ile." He should have admitted to the whole amount. In terms of the logic of Rabbah, this line seems completely extraneous. And what is it coming to explain? So Rashi, not here, but in Baba Metzia, explains that this line is coming to teach you that even though you might have thought that this person, since he was Chashud HaMamona, since he is willing to lie about the monies that he owes, then he should also be chashid al shvuato. He should also be chashud to take a shvuah. Because if a person is willing to lie and steal, then he also should not be believed when it comes to a shvuah. What the Gemara is coming to explain over here, not the first part, which Rashi says was explaining why by modi miksat yes and bekover bekol lo, but now it's trying to explain why by modi miksat is even entitled to take a shvuah. He's willing to steal. Why should he take a shvuah? The Gemara answers because he should have denied the whole thing. He wanted to deny the whole thing. The fact that he didn't deny it shows you that he has some guilt. He has feelings over here, and that this person really wants to do the right thing. And since he really wants to do the right thing, we can believe him by a shvuah because he's not really trying to steal over here. He's trying to buy time so that he can pay back the money in an easier fashion for himself. But that's why we do believe him when we force him to take a shvuah. Tosafot says that he thinks Rashi's explanation is incorrect. Number one, he thinks that even if he was chashud of amona, that doesn't necessarily preclude him from being chayav or ne'eman by a shvuah. And he says, don't say that Rashi is right here, that min haTorah, just like he lied and stole, so therefore he's not believed by Yeshua, but the Chachamim imposed a Yeshua on this individual, because they saw people were willing to steal, but they weren't willing to take a Yeshua to Sheker. So thereby, by imposing the Yeshua midrabanan, they could stop this process. Tosaf says, don't say that, because that's not the case, because even min haTorah, this individual is believed by a Yeshua. And then Tosafot wants to explain why is it that when a gazlan or someone steals, he is pasul eidut, yet now we're saying that he is kasher l'shvuah. So Tosafot says something that is very important and is clear in the Gemara, that there was this psychology about shvuot, that a shvuah was something that was very, very dangerous, severe, and people wouldn't just do it willy-nilly. A shvuat sheker was something that people stayed away from, because of the number of Yisurim involved in it, the fact that it says, Lo Yinakeh, Hashem will not clear anybody of doing such a thing, as well as many other items that come along with a Shvu'ah. And even when Beit Din, we know in the Gemara in Shvu'ot, talks about the fact that Beit Din used to make the people fearful of the Shvu'ot and explain to them how dangerous it is to take a Shvu'ah Sheker. So they understood that there was this psychology amongst people not to take a Shvu'ah Sheker, even though they were willing to steal. And again, this goes back to a fact that we've mentioned many times, that people are much more makpid at ben adam l'makom than ben adam l'chavero. They're willing to steal, they're willing to do all these other things, but when it comes to between them and God, they're not willing to do that. They're not willing to lie to God, they're not willing to take a shvuat sheker. Now, the last thing to note over here is that the structure of the Gemara says that a person who is modeh miksat has to take a shvuah. Person is a kofer bakol does not have to take a shvuah. Now, as Rashi explains, the reason that by kofer akol he doesn't have to take a shvuah is because chazaka in adam is panav. A person's not willing to deny face to face or whatever because of the gratitude he owns this individual. And therefore, if he says it, we should believe him. That's the way Rashi learns it. We saw that Tosafot disagreed and said that it was gzerat haketuv or the fact that there was no available gilgul shvuah over here by kofer bakol. And therefore, the person is patur. But you have to remember now, if you're dealing with people who are stealing or people who are not honest, then after a couple of times, they're going to catch on to the game. And they're going to start realizing that if instead of being modeh b'miksat, they're kofer bakol, and if they're kofer bakol, then they won't have to take a shvuah, that it's a much better claim for them, despite the psychological impediment to doing that. But if they realize that it's going to save them from a shvuah and from having to admit to the whole thing, what people in the end are going to do is they're going to learn to be kofer bakol. Based on that, I heard from Rav Meir Lichtenstein that he suggested that Rav Nachman, who is a dayan, was the one who instituted something called shvuat hesed. Shvuat HaSeit is a shvuah midrabanan that is imposed on people who were kofer bakol. And what Rav Meir suggested is that the reason that Rav Nachman instituted the shvuat HaSeit by kofer bakol was that was the next generation, or when people got smart to the fact that if you were kofer bakol, you'd get out of the problem, then they switched from being modeh b'miksat to kofer bakol because they knew that it would clear them and they wouldn't have to take a shvuah. So Rav Nachman plugged that hole by putting in a shvuat HaSeit and saying that even if you go the route of kofer bakol, you're going to still have to take a shvuah, and therefore you take it back basically to the original stance, which is that the people will then be governed by the psychological sides of this, which would push them towards being modeh b'miksat rather than kofer bakol, because they don't get out of a shvuah no matter which way they go, and therefore it reverts it back to the base psychological concept that we saw in Rabbo's position. Okay, now the next mission begins. Eidim shamru k'tav yadenu ze. Aval anusim ayinu. They say that, yes, what you see on this shtar, we did sign this shtar. What is here is our handwriting, but we were forced to sign the shtar. Hainu, k'tanim hainu. Yes, we signed the shtar, but we were minors at the time that we signed the shtar. P'sulei edut hainu. Or we were invalid to give edut over here. Rashi brings two possibilities of why they were p'sulei edut, either krovim, they were relatives, or misachakim bekubya, or that they were people that were pasul because they were gamblers. Some of the Rishonim take issue with Rashi because then it's madam misim atzmo rasha. Person is making himself into a rasha by saying that he's a gambler, and therefore they only accept the one explanation of Rashi, that krovim, that they were relatives, which is a psul, not because there's something wrong with them, but simply because of their relationship to the party. And what they can claim is that, yes, we were krovim, but we just thought they wanted us to sign in the interim. They knew we were relatives, and they knew we weren't kshirim. They just wanted us to sign until they got really deemed to sign over here. So that's would be their claim, that which would not make them into rishayim. Others, on the other hand, say misachakim bekubya, or misachak bekubya, and the Gemara in Sanhedrin is a machloket as to why they're a pasul. One of the opinions is that it's because of smachta lo kanya, and therefore they are gazlanim. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda is of the position that it's mipnei sheyushuvo shel olam. The fact is that people are gambling are not involved in productive occupations or things that help out the world. It's simply an item that has no utility in terms of bettering the world. And therefore, the mafkamina there, the Gemara says, if he has an alternative job, and this is only done as a sidebar, or even if they are psulim, they're not psulim because they're rishayim, they're psulim because they don't really understand what it means to work hard for money, they don't understand what the travails of individuals are because they're gambling all the time, and they have no sense of what normal people engage in, or how they make a living. But that way, they won't be making themselves necessarily into Rishayim, and that's why you could explain it even according to Rashi, that that was the psul over here. So, Harilu, Nemani, these individuals are believed over here because it's a Pesha Surah, Pesha Yetir. They're the ones who are telling us that their signatures on this document are valid, but they're also telling us at the same time that they were invalid when they signed it. On the other hand, in Yesh Edim, if there are witnesses to the fact that they signed that, Shukatav Yadam, that it is their handwriting, or in another contract in which Beit Din already given approval and had written that this is a valid contract, which means that the Edim were validated, we find their handwriting, and it matches to this, then they're not believed, because we don't need them to uphold the contract anymore. The contract is valid without them. There, they don't have the right to come along and then say, though, the contract's not real because we did something wrong, we have something invalid about our Edut. Because now they're coming to undermine something that has already transpired, and we're going to see why that is the case. Samarami Brachama, Lo Shana Elisha Amru Anusim Ainu Machmat Mamon. It's only true if they say that the reason that we were forced to sign this document was because of money. We were paid off to sign it. Aval Anusim Ainu Machmat Nefashot. If we were forced to sign it because they threatened us with our life if we didn't sign it, Harielu Nemanim. Then they are believed in that case. So now, what Rami Bachama says is, even if we find out that the document is valid from other parties, the question is, now, why are the Edim saying that they signed it improperly? If they say we signed it improperly because we were paid off, then, in Ochanami, they're not believed over here. We're not going to listen to them, first of all, make themselves into Rishayim, and we're not going to give them the right to come and invalidate a contract which seemingly is valid and they signed on. On the other hand, if they come along and say that we were forced to gunpoint to sign the document, in that case, we will believe them. So Amalei Rova, Rova says back to Rami Rechama, Kol Kaminei, what right do they have here to come and undermine the validity of this contract? Kevin Shigid, Shuvenu Chuzer Magid. We have a principle by Eidut, which is that once an Eid has given testimony, he cannot retract or change that testimony. Now, this is only true if he gave the testimony in court, and the testimony was investigated by the Beit Din, but once the testimony has been given, you don't have a right to change that testimony or to perjure yourself by changing what you said before. And that's what's happening over here. Over here, they signed it. Their signing of the document was a testimony to the validity of the document. And now all of a sudden, they're coming trying to change their testimony. If you say that's only when they speak in front of Beit Din, the Edim, and they give oral testimony, that's when they can't change their mind. aval bishtar lo, but when they're in a shtar, that is considered not to be edut, like edut in front of a beit din, and they can change their position. V'hama Reish Lakish, doesn't Reish Lakish tell us, edim achatumim al shtar, witnesses that sign a shtar, nasek misha nechraka edutam bebeit din, have the status or the equivalence of someone whose edut has been checked out in beit din, meaning that they are equivalent of witnesses coming and testifying before the beit din. If that's the case, they're going to be subject to the same rules, which is kevin shigid shuvenu chuzer magid. They can't go back from what they have said. And Reish Lakish's din seems to be an extension of the principle that the Chachamim note in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which is that even though in general, when it comes to edut, whether it's edut on capital crimes or edut in civil matters, in monetary matters, we should have to do drisha v'chakira, we have to check out the edim. Nevertheless, the Chachamim were makil by dinei mamonot in order to ensure liquidity in the lending markets, because if we put too many obstacles on the ability of edim to come to testify and to be proper edim, then the creditors wouldn't lend because it would be too difficult for them to get witnesses that could allow them to get the money back from the debtors. So in order to facilitate a liquid market, the Chachamim were makil by the edut of mamon. And what many of the Rishonim suggest over here is that Reish Lakish's din here is just an extension of that principle, which is that once edim sign on a document, it's nasek amish nechagai dudam bebeit din, it's the equivalent of being checked out in beit din, just like by dinim emonot. When the edim come to beit din, we don't give them as hard a time as we would with capital offenses, because we want to keep the markets liquid and we allow for business transactions to take place. And that's what's happening over here. Now, the only question we have to note here in that first statement of Rami Bar Chama is that what Rami Bar Chama suggests is that the individuals, these edim, can come along, and after we know for sure that the shtar is valid, they can come along and deny the fact that it was signed properly. They can invalidate it. Now, if that's the case, then why is the only way they can invalidate it through if they were threatened with their lives in order to sign it? Why can't they say we were krovim? Why can't they say that any other soul that was there? The Ramban over here explains that there's a difference. By the case where they said they were done at gunpoint, or they were threatened with their lives to sign it, over there they're not making themselves into rishayim. They were under duress, and they're explaining that they signed it under duress. On the other hand, if the other claims that they would make would actually make them into rishayim, and would implicate them in doing something wrong, there they don't have a right. They don't have a right to come and invalidate a document by saying that something wrong was done. They have a right to say that it was done under duress, but they don't have the right to say that it was done in an invalid manner once the document in a sense has been validated. Reish Lakish's answer or why that doesn't work at all is because once they've signed or once it's been signed on the document, we don't go back and look whether it was done under duress, not under duress. Once it's signed and once the document's in place, that's it. That's the way it is. And we don't question, we don't allow them to question the validity of such a document. If that's the case, then even if they say that we did it under duress, they should not be believed. Elaki itmar, areisha itmar. So rather, Rami Bar Chama's statement is not made on the latter half of the Mishnah, but rather on the front half of the Mishnah. And if in the latter half of the Mishnah they really had done it under duress, they should have gone to Beit Din or to other Edim and told them that after the fact, in order that they could come to testify later on. The fact that we didn't hear and they were mum about this till this point in time makes us question the validity of their statement. So rather, Rami Bar Chama is on the ratio, which is Hareyu Elu Ne'emanim. They are believed. Amar Rami Bar Chama, Lo Shanu Elu Shamru Anusim Ainu Machmat Nefashot. They're only believed if they say that we were under duress with our lives, we were threatened with our lives, and that's why we signed it. If Amru Anusim Ainu Machmat Mamon, Ne'emanim. On the other hand, if they say the reason we signed it was because we took bribes, we took money for it, we needed the money, ein ne'emanim. They are not believed. My taimo. What's the reason? Ein adam misim atzmo rasha. Because a person cannot incriminate themselves. As Rashi explains over here, adam karov etzel atzmo. A person is a relative, he's the closest relative to himself. And just like a relative cannot testify for good or bad, so too an individual can't testify for good or bad about themselves. And over here, they are implicating themselves in doing something bad, something wrong. And ein adam misim atzmo rasha. Therefore, we do not believe them. We do not believe what they said over here. And if we don't believe what they said, then they can't invalidate the document. So they're only ne'eman when they say something which does not incriminate them. But if they say something that does incriminate them, then we're not going to believe them because ein adam misim atzmo rasha. Now, Tosafot asks over here, Rova in other places in Shas tells us that we are what called pagin and dibura. We split, we bifurcate the statement of the edim of the witnesses, and we say that what they said or the information that they said there does not relate to themselves, we'll accept. Anything that relates to themselves, we will not accept. So for instance, when an individual goes says to a woman, he's testifying that her husband passed away and says, I killed your husband. So in that instance, we believe him with regards to the testimony of the wife that the woman can go out and marry. We do not believe him with regards to the statement about himself that he was the murderer of this individual and makes himself into a rasha. So we bifurcate his statement as to be a testimony about the husband and a testimony about himself. The testimony about the husband we believe. The testimony about himself we do not believe. Since we do not believe the testimony about himself, he cannot incriminate himself. And if he can't incriminate himself, he remains a kasher aid. And therefore his edut is helpful in that case. So Tosfot asks, why don't we say the same thing over here? When these individuals come along and say that we were anusim mibayei mamon, why don't we say, number one, they were anusim, they were under duress, and mamon is meisim atzmo rasha. So let's forget about the mamon part and just say anusim, they were under duress, and we should believe them because anusim lenefashot should count. Tosfot gives a number of answers to this. One answer is that somebody putting under duress of life to sign a document is very rare. So therefore, it's not really a good claim. And we wouldn't be pagin and diburo with such a poor claim and say, oh yeah, they meant nefashot. Because unless they say it, it's a very unlikely outcome. And since it's an unlikely outcome, we're not going to divide up their testimony into saying that they were under duress of their life or under threat of their life versus the mamon piece. That's one thing that Tosfot says. The other thing Tosfot says is that in the other instances, there's a clear bifurcation in their statements, which is that there's a modifier afterwards, which allows us to split their testimony. In this case, when they say anusim, when they say mamon or nefashot, that's part of a single statement. They're not saying anusim, it happened to be mamon, or anusim, it happened to be nefashot. They're saying anusim be mamon, or anusim be nefashot. Over there's no room to split or be pagin and dibura, because there's only one dibura over here. Since there's only one dibura, we can't go back then and divide it up. On the other hand, in the other examples in Shas, where we do say pagin and dibura, over there is an easier way to bifurcate the statement into two parts. Okay, Tan Rabbanan. Now we're going to go back and explain on our Mishnah that there's actually a machloket in the ratio of our Mishnah, which is, Ein ne'amanim leposlo. They don't have the right to be poselet, divri Rabbi Meir. Chachamim amrim ne'amanim. They are believed in order to be posel the document in the ratio of our Mishnah. And the reason, Bishlam of the Rabbonon, we understand the reasoning of the Rabbonon, Kitamayu. Their reasoning is, Shapesha suru pesha itir. They're the ones validating the document, but they're also telling us that that validation is invalid, either because they were ketanim, or because they were psulei edut, or they were under duress, and according to Rami Bar Chama, it means only under duress of their life. So in all those cases, they're not really rishayim, they didn't do anything wrong, so therefore we're going to say a pesha sur pesha itir, and that's why they're granted believability. Ela Rabbi Meir, my taimo. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Meir's position that they're not believed in these cases? Why doesn't he invoke the principle of Pesha Asur Pesha Tir? So Bishlam Psulei Dot. When he says Psulei Dot, we understand why he doesn't believe them, because Malve Gufe Miikara Midak Daik Omechtam. So the case by a lender, a creditor, will not get people to come sign on his document who are Psulei Dot. He's going to look into the matter. And since he looked into the matter, when we find a deem that are signed on the document and they validate their signatures, then we're going to say they for sure were okay at the time and they don't have a right now to come and change that or the fact that they were psulei edut. It's because here they're testifying that the loan definitely took place and whatever was documented here was true. They're just saying that the document itself is invalid. So as far as the loan, they've now upheld the loan or the transaction. In terms of their ability to invalidate the document, they don't have that ability because Rabbi Meir says we have an offsetting factor here. Yes, Pesha Asu, Pesha Hitir, but Rabbi Meir says the fact that the Malve would not have signed Psulei Edut on his contract gives us a mitigating side to say that we don't believe them over here. And therefore, based on that, we're going to say, yes, they just validated the loan. On the other hand, their invalidation of their signature is not strong enough to overcome the fact that a Malve will check into the Edim before he signs them on them. Ketanim Nami. Ketanim also. Why do we not let make the claim of ketanim? Rabbi Shimon Lakish, Domer Ish Lakish, Chazaka Ein Aedim Chotmim Al Ashtar Elim Kein Aseh B'Gadol. That there is a chazaka that the individuals who sign on a document are gedolim, are of age. Again, similar in vein to what we said before, the malveh is not going to bring people, and this could have been the answer of the Gemara as well, which is that people malveh is not going to bring ketanim or minors to sign on his document. There is this chazaka that the individuals who sign a document are of age. And therefore, our assumption is that anybody whose name is mentioned on a document is someone of age, and that people will not allow ketanim to be involved or minors to be involved in these types of transactions. And if that's the case, once they validate the loan or validate their signatures, then automatically the assumption is that they were a gedolim because of this chazakah, and they don't have a right to deny it. And that's why Rabbi Meir says in both of these instances, we do not say a pesha asur or a pesha hitir, in a sense because once they validated the loan, then the loan automatically assumes that they were edim ksherim, and they don't have a right now to come back and testify a second time that all of a sudden they weren't ksherim, because their testimony on the shtar, in a sense, is already a full testimony. And this might, according to some of the Rishonim, connect back to what Reish Lakish says before, and this is the reasoning underlying Reish Lakish's position. Why is it that the edim achatumim al shtar are nasu kemish nechra eudutam? It's because the malvit checks out. And number two is, there's a chazaka that they are gedolim. So all of these factors generate an edut or a signature that is on a shtar to be a valid signature without the ability of someone to come back and testify to the fact that it was invalid. It's automatically validated because of these factors. The malveh checks into it, chazaka, they're gedolim. And the fact now that they've told us that these are their signatures, if they come to testify now, it's as if they testified once and now they want to come and undermine that previous testimony that they do not have a right to do. But the problem for Rabbi Meir is El Anusim. My taima. Why by Anusim does Rabbi Meir say that we don't believe them? Am Rav Chista, Kasava Rabbi Meir, Edim, Shamru Lehem, Chitmu Sheker, signed falsely, Val Te'argu, and then you won't be killed. Yehargu, V'al Yachtimu. They should die and not Val Yachtimu Sheker, and not sign falsely. Meaning, Rav Chista says, what you conclude from this is that a person would have to give up his life before he signs falsely on a document. Amar le Rava, hashta yilu atu lekaman lemluche. Had they come and asked us what to do, had they come in front of us and said, listen, people are threatening us with our lives if we don't sign this document. They come to Beit and they say, what should we do about this? Amrinu lo zilu chatumo velo tit kitlun. And we would tell them, we would advise them, go sign and don't be killed. Damar mar, because the locha is ein lecha davar shu mei bifnei pikuach nefesh. There's nothing that stands in the face of protecting one's lives. Ella, the three cardinal sins, which are avodah zarah, gilui arayot, and shvichat damim, bilvad. Those are the only three cardinal sins where a person is obligated to give up their life. And according to Rava himself, it's not even so clear that that's always. That's only it's bivahestia, but see now you may not have to give up your life, meaning that it's not even clear that even these three. But even if we grant you these three, certainly one does not have to give up their life in order not to sign a document falsely. So if he came to Beit Din and we would advise him, we would tell him, go ahead and sign. Now you're going to say to them after they signed, after the fact they signed, we're going to say, why did you sign it? We're going to say, you should have given up your life? No, of course they signed it. They signed it because they were under duress, and that's the advice we would give them as well. So why shouldn't we believe them in this case? Ela taima de Rabbi Meir ki de Rav Huna Marav. The reasoning behind Rabbi Meir's position is because of this statement of Rav Huna Marav. Dam Rav Huna Marav, mode bishtar shekatvo ein tzarich l'kaimo. When someone admits to the fact that a shtar has been written, you do not have to get it validated. So what Rashi claims over here is that when the loveh, when the debtor agrees to the fact that this loan was entered or this shtar is a good shtar, then we don't have to go and get it validated and baked in. It's automatically validated. And as Rashi says here, then the loveh's got to pay, because if he doesn't pay, we're going to say to him, why does the malveh still have the shtar in his hands? Since he has the shtar in his hands, and you basically admitted that there was a loan over here, there was a shtar over here, you should be obligated to pay, and there's no way that these edim can come and invalidate the shtar. Once the loveh is admitted to it, the edim don't have a right to undermine that statement of the loveh, of the debtor in this case. That's the way Rashi explains it. Tosafot, on the other hand, says that he doesn't think that Rashi's explanation is correct here, that the loveh agreed to the shtar or admitted to the shtar over here. Because if that was the case, then the machloket here should be within a case of a loveh himself, whether the loveh admitted or didn't admit to the shtar. But that's not what we see over here. We see that the argument in the Mishnah is about edim, third parties, not about the loveh himself. Therefore, v'nira l'rabbeinu tam l'ri, d'achi peirusho, taima d'rabbi meir, the reason behind Rabbi Meir is kid Rav Huna. It's not exactly like Rav Huna, but the same logic as Rav Huna. So even though by a loveh we don't invoke a migo, that the loveh is believed, Over here, the Lover comes along and says the shtar is valid. Now, why don't we believe him when he says, now I paid a portion of it back? Because he could have said the whole thing is mizuyaf. It was false, or he didn't have to admit to the shtar at all. So what do we see? When the Lover admits to it, we say that there is no migo, he's not protected. And once he admits to it, he's chayav to pay the entire amount. Hachanami omer Rabbi Meir be'idim. Rabbi Meir applies the same logic be'idim. Tavagav dalime lopas le'shtar b'migo. Even though they are stronger, they cannot ruin the document through amigo. So once they have validated the document and said it is a good document, then they don't have a right afterwards to go down and invalidate the document. Just like a lové who agrees that the document is true and the loan is true, he doesn't have the right to say pirativ, even though it's a pesha sur pesha tir. So to over here by the edim. The question is, why not? And that's what Tosfot says. And the next Tosfot asks, why doesn't the lové have amigo over here? Why can't he lie and basically say that it was mizuyaf? It was a false shtar. If that's the case, he should be believed when he agrees to the shtar. So Tosfot says, similar to what he said by the case of Moda Miksad versus Kovar Bakol, the claim of mizuyaf is not a great claim. Because he's afraid that he might get denied. Or that mizuyaf is a claim that's dangerous because other people could come and undermine him. So he wants to take a tact that doesn't undermine him, where he says, the shtar is valid, but I paid back a portion of it. And that's why we don't believe him, because he doesn't have amigo. Rashi, on the other hand, in other places says that the Torah does not really require kiyum edim on a shtar. And a shtar is automatically mikuyam, but it's only the Rabbonon that instituted that a person has to do kiyum edim. So in the end, the shtar is valid even without the statement of the Lové. So therefore, the Lové doesn't have a amigo over here in order to come and deny the fact, because kiyum edim or kiyum of a shtar is only a din de Rabbonon. Although Tosfot does not agree with Rashi's explanation as to why the Lové is chayav over here, Rashi says the Lové is chayav over here because the Malveh has the shtar in his hand. And what we say to him, why does the Malveh have the shtar in his hand if you already paid him back? Tosfot says that's not the case. The reason he's chayav over here is because he lost his migo. And since the Lové has no migo, he's not Neeman. And that's what obligates him to pay in this instance. And therefore, that's what Tosfot says over here. Just like by the case of the Lové, Rav Huna and Rav say that once he's admitted to the validity of the shtar, he doesn't have a right to undermine it, and he has to pay. Rabbi Meir says that's the same thing by the Edim. Just like by the Edim, once they've validated the shtar, the transaction is now in place. They don't have a right after that to come and deny it or to undermine it. Even though generally you have a principle, Pesha Asur, Pesha Yitir, Rav Huna and Rav say that doesn't always apply. That is, by the case of Lové, it doesn't apply. Rashi says, because the Malveh is holding on to the contract. Tosfot says, because there's no Migo over here. And the same thing will be true by the Edim as well. That we will extrapolate that din to say, once there's a validation of the shtar, then there's no right to undermine it, no matter what the Edim say afterwards. And no matter that they could have a Migo over here. It might be for the same reason that Rashi says before, which is that, Mina Torah, you don't really need the Kiyum HaShtar, it's all Midrabanan. And therefore they really don't have a Migo to be Neman. And once the shtar is validated, it remains valid, and they don't have the right to undo it, even if they claim anusim over here. Okay, we're going to stop here. 12 lines down on the top of Yutet Amud Aleph.